Welcome back to Corn Belt Conversations. I'm your host, Troy Kazire. Today we have Kelly Estes with us. Kelly is the Illinois State Ag Pest Survey Coordinator. We've had Kelly on before, and Kelly, appreciate you coming back to visit with us and share your insight again.
Thanks. I love coming on and chatting with you.
Well, tell us, before we get rolling here, why don't you tell us a little bit about what the role of State Ag Pest Survey Coordinator is, what that role entails, and maybe a little bit about your background.
Sure. I am based at the University of Illinois at the Illinois Natural History Survey. And as the State Ag Pest Survey Coordinator, I have actually multiple roles on campus, which are, for me, very exciting, and I enjoy all the different aspects of it. But I coordinate what is called the Cooperative Agricultural Pest Survey Program. It's a federally funded program through USDA APHIS PPQ. And we work with Illinois Department of Ag, Natural Resources, lots of different cooperators around the state. And the focus is on early detection of pests in the state of Illinois, primarily invasives, but we also are looking at different pests that are moving in from surrounding states or other parts of the U.S. as well. And then I also work within the Department of Crop Sciences and coordinate probably what most people are familiar with is the statewide pest survey in the summer, where we survey counties across the state looking at our endemic pests of corn and soybeans. So rootworms, Japanese beetles, bean leaf beetles, which there's so many. Dectus stem borer is a newer one that we've included in that as well.
Okay, very good. And what's kind of give us a little bit of your background, if you would?
Yeah, I'm originally from Northwest Illinois. I am a U of I grad. And during my time at U of I, I actually took an entomology class and really enjoyed it. And I always knew that I wanted to go into extension. My dad was in extension, and we had such a huge part in 4-H and things like that. And I was able to go to grad school. And at the end of grad school, took a role with Extension on campus as an IPM specialist in entomology, which gave me the opportunity to work with Drs. Mike Gray and Kevin Steffi and Rick Weinzerl, who are now all retired, but really left a great foundation within entomology on campus. And I did that for several years before I took on my State Ag Pest Survey Coordinator role at the Illinois Natural History Survey.
Well, very good. And again, really appreciate you coming on to share your insight. So let's, you mentioned early detection of pests, and we're always interested in what we think might be the problems that we'll be dealing with in the upcoming season. And so let's talk a little bit about this winter, and you know, everybody always wants to know, hey, did we kill off anything over this winter, and what's the outlook for this year? So why don't you kind of walk us through that and kind of where you see things right now?
That is the question that starts as soon as the calendar turns over to January 1st of a new year. But when we start looking at pests and overwintering, we generally look at the winter months of December, January, and February. And year to year, things vary quite a bit, actually. And as we start looking at past years and just doing some comparisons and things like that, as we are also then looking forward. But insects are pretty interesting because they're temperature dependent, and they also overwinter in different stages. So some insects like rootworms are overwintering as eggs in the soil. Other insects like brown marmorated stink bug or stink bugs are overwintering as adults. They'll look for sheltered areas underneath bark in garages and houses and things like that to overwinter. Japanese beetle overwinters as a later instar in the soil. So we have different stages of insects overwintering, and they're all affected differently by temperature. And a lot of times when we say insects are temperature dependent, the warmer it is, the faster they grow. And on the flip side, the colder it is, the greater the chance they may not survive the winter. And so that often leads to the question, was it cold enough to kill off the insects? over the course of the winter. And excuse me, we are looking at average temperatures over those 3 months. We are not only averages, but is it cold enough to, are we to kill off the insects? But there's actually a lot of different factors that go into it. Honestly, greater fluctuations in temperature generally have a greater impact on survival. So if we think to ourselves, you know, we have some warming trends and then you have a quick temperature drop and then it warms up and then another temperature drop is almost or sometimes as effective as extremely cold temperatures. So as the temperatures rise, the insects, they kind of have like, it's an antifreeze inside their bodies. So it allows them as it gets colder to basically drop their body temperature in order to survive it. And then as it warms up, their body temperature starts to warm up. And if you get a quick drop again, they often can't decrease their body temperature fast enough. So that can play a part in survivability as well. And I'm throwing a whole lot of information at you right now.
No, that's great. So, and like you said, all, you know, all of the species are affected a little bit differently by that. I guess which ones are the most susceptible to the, to winter kill in the Corn Belt region?
The ones that most people like to talk about would be Japanese beetles. So they're overwintering in the soil and you often hear them, well, they need to be far enough in the ground to below the freeze level is what they're shooting for. So the colder it gets, the lower that freeze line is. And so you get a greater chance of them not surviving when we have really prolonged extreme cold. And then when we talked about the fluctuating temperatures, different insects maybe that are overwintering above ground are affected more by that.
Okay, sure. And probably one of the most or one of the more hardy species is probably rootworm, right? Overwintering as eggs, those tend to be pretty resilient. They're down in the soil. It's tough to get those cold temperatures down there. Pretty tough to have a winter in our area that's going to do much damage to the rootworm population, isn't it?
It is. They are some of our more resilient insects in wintertime. Often with rootworms, you know, in the winter temperatures play a part, but what happens at the beginning of the growing season often has a greater impact on their potential for the new season, more so than the winter temperatures. And for example, if we have a really wet spring, you have very saturated soils, waterlogged soils, when rootworms are hatching, they don't survive that. I can vividly remember Mike Gray at a grower meeting, like, rootworms can't swim. And so when we have that really wet spring, particularly when rootworm hatch is occurring, we have a higher decrease in population as well.
Yeah, absolutely. No, they are notoriously poor swimmers, and while they are pretty resilient during the wintertime, if about the best thing we can have is a deluge in June to drown those little suckers out. So, so coming up, we kind of go maybe in a chronological order here. Probably I'm guessing one of the first ones you're going to be looking at here before too long is a black cutworm moth flight. What are you anticipating there? And I know you do have a moth trapping program. Maybe talk a little bit about black cutworm and your moth trapping program.
Yeah. So we do have our insects that overwinter here, that we deal with, but many of our insects actually migrate from the south, every spring. And two of the ones that we focus on the most are black cutworm and true army worm, and they will move north on storm fronts, on southerly winds, and we generally start watching out for them end of March, beginning of April. And so as part of our insect trapping program, it's funded through a USDA NIFA grant. We utilize traps around the state where we have volunteer cooperators, people who would like to monitor for these. We purchase traps and send them out along with some directions and some visual guides and aids. And then all we ask in return is for them to send in trap counts. And by doing that, we're able to have a network of traps around the state providing real-time information of the insect pests that we're seeing. And so as I sit here with a whole bunch of southerly winds today, I'm thinking I need to go get a trap out. actually, it's a little earlier than what we generally do, but it's been pretty warm. It's been pretty warm in the south. We were in Kentucky over spring break. I did see some noctuids flying around. Did not get a chance to see which ones, but it does kind of get things rolling, actually. And I think the potential is there for a spring with some insect activity. It's warmer in the south. It's warmer earlier. And if we have a very active spring with storms, that will increase the potential of those moths being brought into the Midwest.
And so I know obviously it's getting a little bit late in the game here now, especially for the black cutworm and true armyworm flights. But if somebody wanted to be a part of that program, how do they go about being involved?
Yeah, I still have traps and lures available. And all you need to do is send me an email at kcook8@illinois.edu. That's K-C-O-O-K, number 8@illinois.edu. And we can get those sent out to anybody that might be interested. We do this here in Illinois. Iowa State also has a trapping program, as well as maybe Wisconsin and Indiana as well.
Okay, very good. kcook8@illinois.edu. Now, do you also, later in the season, do you start monitoring for corn earworm flights as well?
Yep. So once we transition from May to June, cutworm and true armyworm kind of go off to the side. And then historically, we've trapped for earworm, corn borer, and fall armyworm. And everybody's still wondering why we're trapping for corn borer, but it is out there. We haven't had a whole lot of luck trapping for it. But we do get reports during the season of corn borer damage, particularly in non-traded corn. And there is a rise in non-traded corn in certain areas of the state. And so we do recommend to if you are able to get some corn borer traps out and keep track of that.
And that's you guys did stop checking. You did stop monitoring corn borer for a few years, didn't you? Or am I wrong about that?
You're not completely wrong. So when I started at the university many, many years ago, and I don't, your listeners may remember this survey report coming out in the fall. We did a corn borer survey in the fall statewide where we would, it'd be like 40 to 50 counties, and you do 5 stops in each county, and you stop the car randomly, and you, 25 stalks, and you're doing visual assessments for injury. And then you split stalks looking for a larva or pupa. And that ended, I forget the year, but as the popularity of traded corn continued to increase, we weren't able to pick any measurable damage up in our survey. And you knew instantly when you were in a refuge area. And that was also back in the time when we had an area of traded and then an area of refuge and not refuge in a bag. So it was just got too difficult and not giving us a lot of good information for the time and effort put into it.
Sure. No, absolutely. And as you said, there is a kind of a rise in non-traded corn. in the Corn Belt. It kind of tends to be in pockets, it seems like, areas where you've got a pocket of organic farming or non-GMO corn. And that is where you see those hot spots. And it is kind of interesting. I've seen a couple of those, and we're at a point where there are some folks in the seed industry that have never actually seen corn borer damage before, and they don't know what it is when they first see it. You know, we've got folks in the seed industry that were, you know, born after BT corn was introduced. And so it's always interesting to come across that and see that happening in the field. So yeah, okay. So corn borer, and you mentioned of course corn earworm as well, and fall armyworm. And those, again, those really rely on storm systems in the south, kind of coming up through the Gulf to push the moths up into our area, right? I mean, there are years we don't see in the in the I states, for example, there are years we don't see hardly any earworm at all.
It is, and the past few years we've seen a lot in traps, but not necessarily translating into injury, particularly into commercial fields. Still a huge pest for sweet corn growers, as well as some seed companies as well, depending on the genetics and traits that they're working with. But, as part of our invasive species surveys, we're trapping for different moths that are not well known by most people in the ag industry, but they are present in other countries. So we're monitoring for them here. Things like Egyptian cottonworm, and we monitor for Old World bollworm, which is, if you follow corn production, particularly in South America, it's a huge pest down there, identical in appearance to corn earworm. In South America, it's also resistant to several pyrethroids, and we've intercepted it at airports here in the U.S. So it's something that we in Illinois are concerned with, wanting to make sure it's not here. But the traps and lures that we use to monitor for it actually will attract corn earworm as well. And so we actually, based on that trapping, we know that there's a lot of earworm in the state. But luckily, with the advancements in technology, we can do DNA testing, and we send off all of our samples to Colorado. And here with our Illinois field crop survey, we've not found that.
So I don't know, this may not necessarily be your focus. We haven't really talked much about soybean insects at all. And I know, fortunately, of course, Illinois, your area, you probably haven't had to deal with soybean gall midge, but have you been doing anything, or do you have any insight on bean leaf beetle, aphids, any of the soybean insects, and kind of what the outlook might be there?
Yeah, I actually love doing soybean surveys. We do sweep surveys in season to know what's going on and where pests are at different points in the season. So a big one has been Dectus stem borer, primarily found in the southern part of Illinois, though it we've actually found it as far north as DeKalb, as far west as Pike County. I mean, it is statewide, but higher in numbers in the southern part of the state. Interestingly enough, things like bean leaf beetle, grape calaspis, when we are looking at those soybean surveys, the numbers have been pretty low the past few years. It's not to say that they're not a potential pest problem. I think with bean leaf beetle early season, even grape calaspis early season, potential is there. I think it's all about timing and seasonal conditions. But we have not seen much in the way of bean leaf beetle injury in season in soybeans in a couple of years. And we do soybean gall midge survey as part of a detection survey we do. As we travel around, we stop at soybean fields. Not only are we doing sweeps, but we're also doing visual surveys along edges of soybean fields, looking for the telltale signs of injury along the base of the stems, calloused areas. If we were to find something like that, we would split a stem and look for the larvae. but we've not found any of that here in Illinois.
No, and obviously we'll cross our fingers that it that we can keep that spread in check. Obviously, it's been a big deal in Iowa. It has been spreading, and we've talked about that on this podcast in the past. And hopefully we can keep it in check. We'll just have to kind of see what happens. So kind of along those lines, or you know, when we think of something spreading like that, you do some work with invasive species as well. And I know that's kind of your kind of really in your wheelhouse and one of the things that you enjoy spending time on. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that, that part of your role and some of the invasive species that you're really focusing on in this area.
So the invasive species surveys do make up a majority of my time here on campus. We're looking at new or not known to occur insects and diseases here in the state of Illinois. We work with USDA and Department of Ag. We sit down every year and look at different things that we want to look at. So in the past, we've done orchard surveys, vineyard surveys. We do pathway surveys. A lot of insects are moved by people, so we look at the pathways in which they can be introduced. But corn and soybeans is a huge part of the Illinois commodity. And so field crop surveys are a huge invasive survey as well. And I mentioned we do things like old world bollworm and Egyptian cottonworm. While we're out there, we're also looking for different diseases. Even like we think several years ago when tar spot wasn't as huge of a deal, we were looking for tar spot, bacterial leaf streak, whole bunch of diseases that I can't pronounce because they don't have common names. But so, yeah, we're looking. And I think one of the things we do is you look for the anomaly in a field. It's something that doesn't look right. And then, like things for diseases, we run through the University of Illinois Plant Clinic so they can rule out if it is something different than what we normally have. But insects are a huge thing. And right now in Illinois, while not necessarily a crop pest, like field crop pest, spotted lanternfly has been huge. It's widespread along the East Coast. And we found it for the first time in Illinois back in September in Cook County. So we expect it to potentially be found in other areas of the state of Illinois in this coming year. And that will be a huge survey and also public response, probably. We get a lot of reports of different insects. And one of my jobs is to look at different reports and identify what they are and answer questions and things like that. So we'll be responding to different reports, mapping, and getting more information out on spotted lanternfly this year.
And tell us just a little bit more about that particular pest. You said it's not really considered a crop pest, but what is it doing out there in the environment that is of concern?
So while not a concern in corn and soybeans, some of our specialty crop growers, it is a concern to grape growers. They have some potential, we think, apples or beeches. They're not a huge pest there. But they also feed on different hardwood plants, so like trees and bushes as well. They're also considered probably a public nuisance when you think of it is a leaf hopper. So it has a needle-like mouth part, so piercing sucking. And when you think of insects like that, it's very similar to aphids. And we can think back to soybean aphids and how they would leave honeydew on soybeans, and then you have sooty mold. So when you have lots of spotted lanternfly, they are also emitting honeydew and sooty, and then with consequently sooty mold on it. And so there's lots of potential for impact of plants, but also reports from the East Coast of honeydew on sidewalks, on picnic tables, and covering play structures or back decks and things like that. So we're definitely not at a spot where we're looking at hundreds of thousands in an area, but we are monitoring where we might find it, how big those populations are.
Beyond the mold that comes along with the honeydew, is there any other disease vector concerns with spotted lanternfly?
No, luckily not. It's a plant feeder. It likes tree of heaven. And then other big host plants would be grapes, wild grape. I think red maples are right up there, birch trees. So smaller trees are probably going to be a little more susceptible. Not killing them right away, but when you have a bigger population or repeated feeding over time, it's going to affect plant health. And then you'll get a steady decline of plants and then ultimately plant death. But it's a relatively new pest that we are continuing to learn about.
All right. Well, great information. Appreciate that. So to wrap things up, the one thing that's been in the news a lot lately is the horde of the biblical horde of cicadas that we're expected to have this year. So what can you tell us? What can you tell us there?
Well, in certain areas of the state, I think you should expect lots of insects and lots of noise. In some ways, I'm very much looking forward to it because I want to see it. But, it's just one of those weird bug nerd things. So, for us personally, I can remember when I first started, we were doing trapping. We're up in Rockford. And so we put our traps out. Some traps are checked every other day, but some of our other traps are checked every 2 weeks, and you just come back to a trap full of cicadas. So, I think it's not going to be quite as monumental as the eclipse coming up, but I think it's going to be pretty noteworthy. And I know that Illinois Extension's put out some good information, and I know there's some more information coming out with how to handle it, and just some general messaging, depending on where you're at, how to best deal with it in terms of gardens and things like that as well.
All right. Well, very good. Well, we'll keep our eyes open. It promises to be kind of an interesting event this summer. We'll see how it unfolds. Well, again, Kelly Estes, Illinois State Ag Pest Survey Coordinator. Appreciate you taking your time and sharing your insight with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. And thanks to everyone for listening. And we'll see you next time on the next Corn Belt Conversation. Thank you.